Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130 and 103.5 FM. Justice and Drew, along with Sam. Going to be talking with Andrew Langer here in just a minute. Did you see over the weekend that Vern Troyer passed away?
Yeah.
49 years old.
Yeah, pretty young.
Played Dr. Evil's small silent sidekick, Mini-Me. He did a lot of stuff. He had a fairly successful career. Statement provided by Troyer's representatives. That was also posted to his Instagram and Facebook accounts that the actor died on Saturday. No cause of death was given, but the statement describes Troyer as a fighter who was unable to overcome a recent bout of adversity, then goes on to discuss depression and suicide, unfortunately. Mm. So that's some horrible news there.
He was successful, but he had his issues. He had his struggles for sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
This segment of Justice and Drew is brought to us by our friends from Randy's Electric. They are proud to sponsor our DC correspondent every single Monday, Andrew Langer from the Institute for Liberty. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, gents.
There you are. We were just discussing, I know we got a lot to get to, but we were just discussing the progress that Trump has made on the North Korean issue over the weekend, and how even still with truly historic steps being taken by both parties here, the media and the left absolutely refuse to give him any credit on this issue, even going so far as to say, they haven't really agreed to denuclearization. Do you get the sense that they would almost rather North Korea remain a nuclear threat?
Well, I mean, certainly they're never going to give him credit for it, regardless of what happens. I mean, we are looking at the possibility, truly, of having a unified Korea within the next few years. That's a legitimate possibility for the first time in decades, frankly. And, you know, unlike the Iran nuclear deal, which wasn't really a nuclear deal at all, right? I mean, we really gave away the store in a literal sense to Iran. Here we have North Korea coming to the table with no preconditions, and Trump is not going to get any credit. And this is the thing. It really is about Trump's negotiating style here. And essentially, listen, I have no doubt in my mind that it wound up being a sort of a good cop, bad cop situation where the South Korean president went to Kim and Kim's people and said, listen, I don't know what this guy's going to do. You see the papers. You see how unstable he looks. Better we talk now, you and me, and come to the end. That's a legitimate negotiating tactic. I think this is exactly what happened.
It'll be really interesting to see when that meeting, hopefully when it takes place between the president and Kim Jong-un. I'm more curious at this point about what the reaction is going to be from the media than I am of what the actual meeting is going to be about. And we can spin this over to this ridiculous DNC lawsuit. I mean, they're really kind of showing their hand, because it looks like a clear sign of desperation, as is this unwarranted, in this case, criticism of Trump in looking at what's happening with North Korea and South Korea right now.
Well, let's be clear. The DNC lawsuit against the Trump administration in Russia is all about fundraising for the DNC. They really need to do it. They have no real agenda except being anti-Trump going into the fall. They don't want this. See, here's the funny thing. They know a judge is going to throw it out. They'll make hay about the judge throwing it out. But in the end, the last thing that the Democrats want is discovery. Because, and I don't know if you guys follow this, we may have talked about it a little bit. The real story with the DNC and hacking is the situation. I had a conversation on Saturday with former Congresswoman Nan Haworth, Congresswoman from New York, talking about the Imran Awan situation. He is the Pakistani immigrant who with his family and friends, became the chief IT director for...
Right, yeah.
Debbie Wasserman Schultz, the DNC, and 20% of congressional Democrats was downloading terabytes of information and had access to everything. And yet, is someone never mentioned in any of these stories? So, you know, as the DNC talks about having to rebuild 11 servers, having to throw out, I think it's like 100-plus servers or 100-plus laptops and a bunch of different servers, I mean, no mention of their IT director who's been arrested. The Daily Caller's Luke Rorschach and another reporter were in Pakistan last week doing investigations. The Democrats don't want any of that coming up. They really don't want a lawsuit coming forward.
No, and the media is so quick to ignore that and not give them any coverage. I remember us covering this on the show when more details came out, and this wasn't speculation. It was straight up fact. And yet, without the media coverage of it, without it being a part of the discussion, when you do bring it up, it gives the opposition the ability to go, ah, that's just rumor. That's just tinfoil hat stuff. But that whole situation and circumstance is anything but that.
Well, let's be clear about how far journalism has fallen, right? You know, Luke Rorschach at the Daily Caller should be getting the Pulitzer Prize for the amount of investigative work he's done here. This is an important story, a seminal story, especially as we're talking about IT security and privacy and hacking in politics. The fact that the Democrats may have been infiltrated by Pakistani intelligence is a massive story. He doesn't get the Pulitzer Prize, but what, Maggie Haberman gets the Pulitzer Prize, my classmate from high school, a couple years behind me, gets the Pulitzer Prize for reporting on things that were never verified, for reporting on rumor and gossip. I mean, this is where we are today in America.
Talking with Andrew Langer, president of the Institute for Liberty. Our conversation is powered by Randy's Electric this morning. I know that you wanted to talk a bit about the Comey memos, and one of the things that the Comey memo actually makes really clear is that Comey kind of lied to Trump.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that was the stunning revelation here. So you have a situation, we'll get into sort of these guys creating narratives of their own, but you've got Comey admitting in this memo, and remember these memos, the worst kind of self-serving memos. Right? This is the kind of fiction that someone used to write when they were in grade school, when they would cast themselves as the hero in whatever short story, fantastic short story they were writing. Well, you remember Calvin and Hobbes? Calvin used to fantasize about being a spaceman.
Oh yeah,
this is the kind of writing that Jim Comey's doing, and yet he goes and he says, "Well, you know, I told the president." First of all, he gives the shuck and jive that agents like Andy McCabe are apolitical, thinking that Trump is going to be like every other D.C. politician and believe it, and Trump didn't. But then he says, I would never leak things, Mr. President. I'm not a weasel. And then he goes and he leaks the very memo in which he talks about not leaking, which is just so nuts. It's interesting because he's going to be here in Williamsburg. He's teaching this class on ethics, which still makes me laugh. But I guess the CNN town hall on Wednesday night is going to be from here in my backyard, and I may try to go get tickets.
Well, there's this article out of CET US News, and it's an analysis. Under attack, the FBI becomes a partisan battleground. And what this lays out here in the opening sentence, the agency has been weakened by Trump's attacks, embattled leadership at the Justice Department, and old allies at odds with one another. This whole article reeks of this. Well, again, if it hadn't been for Trump getting elected, we wouldn't be having these problems within the FBI, but not from the angle of Trump is exposing and has exposed these problems, and the FBI has exposed the problems themselves in their anti-Trump mentality for those that have it, right? This whole thing lays out that it's Trump's fault that the FBI is embattled right now.
This is the perspective on things that so long as Hillary Clinton had gotten elected, all of this stuff could have gone on and none of us wouldn't have been any the wiser. And that is perfectly okay for any of these journalists, right? It, so long as they got their favorite, you know, hero, their progressive hero in office, and got in the third term of Barack Obama, which it wouldn't have been, but let them have their fantasy. Then all would have been fine. It's a real sort of ends justify the means situation. But the reality is that this stuff was going on and would have been going on. Remember, Trump was not supposed to win. So this stuff was going on in order to make sure that Hillary Clinton got elected. And had that succeeded, then this all would have been swept under the rug. And that's a very disturbing. It's a very disturbing thing for all of us to swallow.
You know, made this comparison, movie comparison before, but it works so well. It's like so many on the left, I believe, they'd rather just live in the Matrix. Like, if you're not in the Matrix, it's life's kind of difficult, but at least you're free. But you have to deal with all the nonsense. If you're in the Matrix, you just deal with the ignorant bliss of what's provided around you. That's what it feels like. It feels like a majority of people would rather just have the FBI, just let them do what they're doing, even though some of it might not be right, and they're making decisions based off polling numbers. I'd rather have it be that way because everything's just a lot nicer.
Well, John, this gets into this subject that my partner at Institute for Liberty and I have been talking about quite a bit. And this is, there's something really more disturbing here, which is the concept of unlearning liberty, right? The idea that, well, why does a law-abiding citizen need to have a gun anyway,
mm-hmm.
right? You know, if you're not doing anything wrong, then it doesn't really matter if A, government agencies, or B, Facebook or Google is looking into every aspect of your life. And this is how republics fall. I mean, and that's, you know, me being, I don't, you know, really want to be cynical and depressing on a Monday morning, but when we unlearn liberty, when we're willing to sort of, right, again, coming back to movies, to quote Natalie Portman, this is how democracy dies.
Right, that's right, with thunderous applause. Well, it's the scene. Look, to make it more relevant to Infinity War opening up later this week, the first Avengers movie. That moment when Loki shows up in front of that crowd of people and makes them all get on their knees. You people were meant, you know, were meant to be ruled. It pops to mind. This is a difficult process and a growing pain we're all going through. But man, it's necessary. It absolutely is necessary that we go through this.
Yeah, especially a week after Patriots Day and, you know, all of these things where we need to be talking about this. By the way, got my tickets for Infinity War. We're seeing it on Sunday.
Sunday, all right. Yeah, well, yeah, Drew's going Thursday night.
I'm going Thursday night.
I'm going Friday late in the afternoon. Sam, when you going?
Whenever I make it to the movie theater.
Okay, the box office projections for Infinity War are just ridiculous this weekend.
Massive.
Yeah, just ridiculous.
Is going to be a great month. We got this, we got Deadpool, and we got Solo coming out.
I am
so pumped.
Yeah, man. Can I go into the Matrix and just watch movies all the time and just do that?
Yeah. We can all be like Christian Toto. And they listen, lucky guy. He writes about politics, but he also writes about Hollywood.
One more quick one here, Andrew Langer. Out of Yahoo, and this is kind of funny because there's actually a New York Post article that says the opposite, but Hillary Clinton not on ballot is the star of GOP midterm plan. And it says 18 months have passed since Clinton lost the presidency. She holds no position of power, not expected to run for office, and yet Clinton is starring in the GOP's 2018 term midterm strategy. And the article lays out that many are saying this strategy reeks of desperation. I think it reeks of desperation from the left filing lawsuits, the DNC filing lawsuits, and it also points to the fact that the Dems have no leadership. So the only person the GOP can focus on that's in kind of any position and getting coverage on the left is still Hillary Clinton.
Okay, all right, but stop for a second.
Okay.
This has no basis in reality. This article in Yahoo is being written for Democratic readers and you know, pink hat wearing women who are absolutely not paying any attention to actually what the GOP is doing in terms of their strategy. Because what the GOP is going to be focusing on is the economy and taxes and jobs and all of the things that are going right with the world and America. The only person talking about Hillary Clinton is Hillary Clinton and the left-wing media. And so what they're doing is, because these folks don't want to talk about the GOP, because they can't focus on the fact that people are getting real tax relief and more money in their pockets, that the economy is picking up. They can talk about stock market volatility, sure. But the reality is they don't want to have the debate over the economy. So they have to put out this narrative, oh, the GOP is only focusing on Hillary Clinton, which is complete and utter garbage. I haven't seen a single Hillary Clinton ad or sort of narrative that is going out. The only people, you know, she's still talking. And yeah, I mean, you know, folks are making fun of her, but that's not, nowhere is that the GOP strategy moving forward. The GOP is going to focus on the real tangibles on the ground. ground.
But Andrew Langer, they pointed to pamphlets that were circulated during the special election in Pennsylvania earlier this year that said, stop Hillary, stop Pelosi, stop Lamb.
There you go. That's exactly it. And, of course, nobody really knowing where those pamphlets came from.
Right, right. They say it's just a taste of what's to come as the November elections draw closer, say those who control the GOP strategy in the first midterm election since Donald Trump's presidency.
Listen, GOP is going to lose seats. The question is whether or not they'll lose Congress, and I'm not convinced it's going to happen.
But, I'm not either.
You know, I'm out of the prognostication business.
Yeah. And this really is no different. I mean, Democrats are doing the same, employing similar tactics around the country. They're making state local races about Trump, you know, even though those races have nothing to do with Trump. We're seeing it here in Minnesota.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, listen, this is certainly in Maryland, that's what's happening. The more that they're going to try to tie Larry Hogan to Donald Trump, which is insane. Because, you know, there have been very few GOP governors as distant from Trump. I mean, especially given the fact that, you know, Maryland's right next to D.C. But nevertheless, that's what Maryland's fall election is going to be out. Of course, you know, Larry Hogan is once again the second most popular Republican governor in the country. So it makes it hard.
Andrew Langer from the Institute for Liberty, our D.C. correspondent. Thank you so much for joining us. Always enjoy our Monday chats.
Thanks, guys. I'll talk to you next week.
Take care. We'll break down all of the Avengers news next week.
Yeah, looking forward to it.
Coming up just after 7:35 this morning, we'll be joined by the Justice Action Network Executive Director, Holly Harris, in studio. Also, Jason Lewis will be on the phone talking about this criminal justice forum taking place today. We'll have all the details on that. Next, there were some walkouts that took place. Got a couple of articles here. Walkout at One St. Paul High School was about more than just school shootings. Plus, this Star Tribune poll, a strong I'm shocked. This is so shocking. I'm sitting here in all the shocked. Strong majority of Minnesotans support stricter gun control. I'm over here shocked that the Star Tribune poll turned out that way.
Justice.
Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, Justice Andrew, along with Sam. If you go to TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com on the Justice Andrew page, you'll see this post there. It's a quick story out of the New York Daily News. A MAGA maniac was a MAGA maniac taunted and punched a Mexican man and then pushed the victim to the tracks in a Manhattan subway station. He was a magnum maniac.
Well, why is he a MAGA maniac?
Because he was in a Make America Great Again hat and shirt.
Oh.
If you look at the photo, though, right, and you go look at the photo, there's something else that he's wearing. He's wearing suspenders. And
that's the lead.
That's why I pointed out. It's like, because they're looking for the individual, right? Right. The man wearing the red Make America Great Again hat and shirt. The assailant began yelling derogatory statements at the man's ethnicity. Awful. While both were on board the northbound 4 train on Friday, the attacker then followed the victim out of the train at Union Square, punched him repeatedly in the head, and shoved him to the tracks before running off. No arrests have been made, and they're searching for the man. Well, to me, the biggest identifier is not the MAGA hat and t-shirt. It's the fact that he was wearing suspenders. Who wears suspenders these days? Especially in New York.
Mork aficionados. maybe he was cosplaying as Mork.
Apparently. MAGA maniac. That's the only reason why that story exists.
Right.
Was because, we can say MAGA maniac. All right, Pioneer Press. Students at the High School for the Recording Arts in St. Paul, no strangers to gun violence, and they said that enough is enough. Over the past year, the school has lost multiple students and staff members to gun crimes. For them, the national walkout movement is not just about school shootings, but about all gun violence in general. Students at the High School for the Recording Arts released a song that honored a staff member killed exactly 1 year before. Dozens of students joined together last month to record the chorus, "If I Can, You Can, If I Can, We Can." And the story goes and lays out several different victims of gun violence. A junior who lost a brother to gun violence. A senior lost 3 friends in the past 3 years from guns. One other senior, almost a victim of gun violence themselves. who went on to say, I've lost too many family members and friends, and I finally just came to and said, enough is enough. I'm tired of it. I just don't want it to happen to anybody else. So Friday afternoon, the High School for the Recording Arts joined the other students across the metro and the state capital for a rally. Police estimated about 1,000 people attended, chanting, hey, ho, 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 the NRA has got to go. No more silence and gun violence. Look, I hope that they found some solace, mm-hmm. and I hope that they feel better. Sadly, their protest is misplaced, in my opinion. Yeah. This is... You know, what they're calling for is not going to, one, obviously bring back their friends and family that they may have lost, but two, it's going to go anywhere to go and solve this problem. You know, we've got community issues to deal with here.
Yeah, and it's not the NRA that is the source of their problem. It's not the NRA that is the source of this gun violence. I would be willing to bet that of all of the incidents that have affected people that have gone to this school, none of them have anything to do with any NRA members.
Right, right. It this reminds me of something that happened on Friday, and I'm actually glad that it did, because I need to write an email. It's totally serious, by the way. I need to write an email to Blaine High School over this, because I go and Melinda and I trade off picking up Logan because it's been too cold for him to ride his bike. Mm-hmm. They have a student parking lot there, right? And I don't want to come off sounding like, student, these kids today, right? But the lack of awareness that these students have when driving their cars through this parking lot, it's astounding. For one, they're gonna kill somebody. But yet, Friday, I'm waiting in the spot to pick up Logan. I'm in the student parking spot waiting for him to walk out. This Toyota comes flying past me. Right, in a parking lot. It's got to be doing at least 45. Dude's hanging out both sides of the windows, and a guy was draped on the hood.
Oh, my God.
He was draped on the hood, laying back against the windshield as they went flying through the parking lot. You know, and again, it's anecdotal, but when you go through the list, Google the list of the top killers of teens, you know, you get accidents, drugs and alcohol, suicide, heart disease, you know, gun-related or shootings at schools, way, way down on the list, and yet we don't have any walkouts for right. students acting like idiots driving their automobiles.
No, and we've seen it, you know, we saw last week, we had somebody brought a knife to a school and attacked students with a knife. Yeah. I mean, can be just as deadly as a gun. But you didn't see any walkouts or protests in that. It's not about, you know, it's not about protecting schools. It's not about making schools safer. It's about the NRA and it's about the Second Amendment.
And it's really unfortunate, in my opinion, because you look at these students from this high school, the Recording Arts, who have dealt with some really personal issues and lost friends and family members over this. And, you know, there's probably a lot of energy there, right, for those individuals to go and do something. And yet, they do end up getting sucked into this other agenda and narrative. And that's really, really unfortunate, because if they were brought into something that was more tangible and actually could be of better benefit to them and their classmates around them, they could probably do a lot of good. But going out on, you know, going out and protesting and shouting against the NRA, if anything, it's only going to make them maybe feel better about themselves. It's not going to accomplish anything to address the problem.
Right. Guns are just the tool. The problem is we've got a culture of violent, a very violent culture right now. We've got a culture where there is a definite lack of respect for life. And we've got a culture where mental illness is largely going untreated or mistreated.
Right.
You know, if you take away one tool, The people that are dealing with these sort of problems or suffering from these mental illnesses or engaged in a culture where violence is celebrated, they will find another tool.
Yeah. And, you know, to those kids that acting like idiots, this is part of this isn't anything new, right? I know that's not the case. I know that kids do that. But why do kids do that? Because kids at that age, they feel like they're the Terminator. They feel like nothing is going to get them.
Feel invincible.
They feel absolutely invincible, you know? And so it's tough to go and equate that to when you're talking about things like gun violence. But just as a society, we don't look at students that way. We don't paint them sort of in that light to where they do feel that way. And to the point they put themselves in a lot of harm because of the fact that they feel invincible. There's a list of bigger threats out there to students that have nothing to do with gun violence, and yet it shows you just how agenda-driven all of this is. Speaking of which, Star Tribune, majority of Minnesotans support stricter gun laws in the United States, including wide backing for a ban on military-style rifles and a raising of the age for gun purchases 18 to 21, according to a new Star Tribune Minnesota poll. I'm shocked.
What's a military-style rifle?
Scary-looking.
Yeah.
Yeah, one you use in a movie because it looks cool. Look at me. I'm shocked. I'm talking monotone now because of all the shock that the Star Tribune put together a poll, and this is the result that they got.
Right.
Big surprise. Not in the least bit.
651-989-5855 is the phone number. Let's go to Colin calling from Minneapolis. Go ahead, Colin.
Hey, I just wanted to add something about that school in St. Paul. Knowing what I know about St. Paul schools and, you know, people who have gone there and the condition of the district itself, my bet would be, and again, this is pure speculation, that a lot of those people who have lost friends and family members, it's not due to just guns getting up and acting on their own. Chances are, they come from inner city urban environments where gangs and drug culture is glorified. So as a result of that, you know, it's easier for them to blame the NRA boogeyman than it is to address a toxic aspect of the culture and society in which they grow up. Because that takes self-realization as opposed to just pinning the blame on someone else.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. And that's worthy of a conversation and is actually a step towards addressing the larger issue. But unfortunately, you know, that's not what the agenda out there says needs to be pushed. And that's clear when you have these students who, again, are probably motivated to go and do something positive, and yet they're out there chanting, hey ho, the NRA has got to go.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Get rid of the NRA. That's going to solve the problem.
Yeah.
That's going to fix it right there.
651-989-5855.
And coming up next segment, we will be talking with Holly Harris. She'll be joining us in studio. She is the executive director of the Justice Action Network. We will also be joined over the phone by Representative Jason Lewis. We're going to talk about some bipartisan efforts for some significant criminal justice reform making progress here in Minnesota.
Miss any of...
Justice and Drew, along with Sam, screening your phone call, 651-989-5855. Use the hashtag TCNT on Twitter if you want to communicate with us at any point during the show. Coming up right around 8:30 this morning, right at 8:35. Mark Lauder will be joining us. We're going to get into the DNC lawsuit that was filed the end of last week,
or otherwise known as their latest fundraising efforts.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Yeah.
It's so blatant.
It is.
It's so blatant.
And desperate. And dumb. Do we mention dumb yet?
It is. It's a little dumb.
It seemed pretty dumb. Why would you have to have a lawsuit if they're going to be able to take down Trump on collusion?
It's a really bad idea. I don't want to get too far off on a tangent, but this was a really dumb move on their part for a number of reasons that we will get into later. But now we are pleased to be joined in studio by the executive director of the Justice Action Network, Holly Harris. Good morning.
Golly, guys. You all are going to make this talk of bipartisanship a little difficult. Nice segue there.
I was told that we did not have to be bipartisan for this particular segment. No, thanks for coming in this morning.
Yeah, we like to spring that on you at the last minute, you know?
Right.
Actually, though, the work that we do is surprisingly, I wouldn't even call it bipartisan. I would just say it's nonpartisan.
Well, let's start there. Talk about the Justice Action Network and talk about the work that you do.
So we work with groups all over the country. We actually have 17 target states. And by the way, when I woke up in Minnesota this morning, I was like, this can't be the Minnesota that I was told about that was supposed to have like a blizzard. And
yeah, you're about 6 days too late for that.
Yeah.
You just missed it.
And be thankful.
Exactly. Well, we work on reforms all over the country that safely reduce jail and prison populations. You know, we've been throwing a lot of low-level nonviolent offenders, many of whom are just sick, have addiction issues or mental health issues. We've been throwing them behind bars for very long sentences. It's not working. They're getting out. They're reoffending. They're going back to prison. We're no safer. We're throwing good money after bad. And so, you know, our organization really seeks to find alternatives to incarceration for a lot of those individuals. And then we also work on issues like the abusive practice of civil asset forfeiture, where basically the government can just take your stuff when you have never even been accused of a crime. It's really insane. So, we have groups like FreedomWorks that are working across the aisle with groups like the NAACP. Mm-hmm. And that's why, you know, today we're going to be working with, we're going to be on a panel actually with Mayor Melvin Carter and Congressman Jason Lewis from Minnesota. And I can't think of another issue that they would agree on.
Yeah, this criminal justice reform making progress in Minnesota happening today, starting at 2:00. Minnesota State Capitol, room 316 is where this will be taking place. And I guess the forum is from like 2 to 3, and then there's a reception that goes on a little bit later on.
I'll tweet out a link too. You can get more information at justiceactionnetwork.org.
Thank you so much. Yes.
Let's go ahead and bring on Representative Jason Lewis into the conversation. Good morning, sir. Thanks so much for joining us on this Monday morning. You're fantastic, man. What societal changes can we point to that makes this criminal justice reform necessary now? Has this been something that has been sort of brewing for a long, long time? We've got to rein it back in. What can we point to that kind of brought us to where we are today, that brought about this reform effort going on?
That brought about the disparate groups that are all very much interested in this.
Yeah.
Families Against Mandatory Minimums, NAACP, but the American Conservative Union, FreedomWorks. So it's not a right or left issue. It's just a realization at some point, cultural and fiscal, in my view, that what we're doing is far too costly and not having the best benefit for society. It costs, you know, over $400 a day or about $150,000 a year to keep a youth in juvenile detention facilities for nonviolent charges. So if someone runs away from school or if someone runs away from home even, it's probably not the best policy to put them in jail with a hardened criminal or in prison for a long period of time. So in the juvenile justice bill, we're trying to work on that. And then we, you know, extrapolate that into a broader arena with criminal justice reform in general. And I tell you, you know, the Constitution mentions about three crimes, and there are 4,500 federal criminal statutes. So while obviously no one wants anarchy, some wise man once wrote that anarchy is not the absence of law, it is the proliferation of law. There was a fellow that wrote a book years ago called Three Felonies a Day on how the average citizen probably commits three federal felonies a day but doesn't know it.
Wow.
So, and we're seeing this, quite frankly, on the political stage. If there's a prosecutor with enough time and enough resources, they will find something on you. And I'm not certain that's a society that folks that benefits everyone. So that's what we're trying to address, really.
One of the points that I know Justice Action Network puts out, and it makes it real simple. Minnesota has one of the lowest incarceration rates, and it has one of the fastest growing prison populations since 2003, despite the falling crime rates. I mean, that lays it out in pretty stark terms there, Holly.
Yeah, and, you know, part of the reason for that is this opioid crisis that we're dealing with. And guys, you know, I come from Kentucky, where everybody's sick. And if we don't start looking at alternatives to jail and prison, this is going to be a really, really serious problem in this country. People who are sick need to get treated. And if you don't treat them and you just toss them behind bars, they're going to get out. They're going to reoffend. And, you know, our society is really going to become incredibly unsafe. So
I appreciate how bipartisan this issue is. And it kind of speaks to a very, for lack of a better term, libertarian streak that you find on both the left and the right. And just this growing acknowledgement and realization that the way we've been doing this just simply hasn't been working. In fact, it's made lives worse. You know, the part of the prison system is supposed to be rehabilitation. You know, you get out of prison and you start fresh. You start with a better life. More often than not, we're just kicking people out of prison with, you know, no skills, no opportunity to find work. It's very difficult for people with a prison record to find a job. And if you don't have a job, you're oftentimes going to be led into a life of crime. Correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like a lot of this, you mentioned the opioid crisis, a lot of this is not just opioids, but a lot, it's drug related. Is there an increasing acknowledgement, realization that incarceration is not the best way to deal with somebody who's dealing with a substance abuse or drug?
Well, it's been, $1 trillion since 1969 on the drug war, and no one wants to see violent drug pushers anywhere but prison. We all understand that. But the costs of prohibition are indeed expensive. If you take a look at treating these things as a criminal act only and not as a medical issue, as Holly suggested, it's going to be a never-ending cycle. Look, I'm a supply sider. I believe that that incentives alter behavior. So we've got enough research now that show rewards and incentives can work to change offending behavior in all but the most violent of criminals. We ought to be using those in a number of states, as Holly mentioned, Kentucky, but Texas, Maryland, Louisiana have done these sorts of things to reduce recidivism. So that's really what it's come to. But I think you're right, Andrew, and especially impacts on communities of color when it comes to jailing nonviolent offenders for those sorts of abuses.
Preach, Congressman. And I'd like to add as well that we do talk a lot about racial disparities, but actually the fastest growing segment of the prison population is women. And did you know that 1 in 4 women entering our justice system right now are either pregnant or mothers to children under the age of 1.
Wow. Mm.
My home state of Kentucky has the highest percentage of children who've had an incarcerated parent.
Wow.
I mean, that's heartbreaking. So we're not just talking about people who've made mistakes. And admittedly, you know, some who've made some terrible, terrible mistakes. But we're also talking about their children.
Well, and this is a very expensive proposition. Since 1980... the federal imprisonment rate has grown by about 520%, from $970 million to more than $6.7 billion. So the question becomes, who do you want to reserve this very, very costly prison space for? You've got to prioritize. It's got to be reserving this for the most violent and hardened criminals, not everyone that commits some sort of nonviolent first-time offense. So there's also a very, very practical matter here.
And I can tell you, rank and file law enforcement, they want to be out there, preventing domestic acts of terrorism and mass shootings at schools. I mean, they don't want to be busting guys on the street corner smoking a doobie.
Right.
And I'm certainly not advocating for that behavior, although I am from Kentucky. I'm not advocating for that. But I do think the congressman is spot on that we've got to prioritize here. Part of good governing is prioritizing.
Absolutely. That's the voice of Holly Harris. She's with the Justice Action Network. You can find more information at their website, justiceactionnetwork.org. We've also got Representative Jason Lewis on the phone.
I know polling done last year showed that there was new, and we've talked about this, almost universal bipartisan support for the three principles of this criminal justice reform. What if any stumbling blocks are there to moving forward to getting this done?
Well, on the juvenile justice reform, there was a valid court order stumbling block. So if a judge says, look, you can't run away from school again, and a youngster does it anyway, can you throw them in jail? I don't think that's the proper response. There are others who do, and that was a stumbling block, but I think we're getting close to overcoming that. My bill with Democrat Bobby Scott of Virginia, the Juvenile Justice Act, has passed unanimously the House. It is another companion bill in the Senate, which has passed. We're just trying to get it to conference, and when we get it there, it'll pass. The Safe Justice Act that James Sensenbrenner, another colleague in the House, have worked on years prior, is a little bit more ambitious, but I think it's also spot on and needs to be done. And I think that's going to take a while. My own view is that if I can get juvenile justice done, that the Safe Justice Act will then get a little head of steam on. So, look. This is all about, as Holly says, good governance, prioritization. In a time when we've got a $21 trillion debt, we've got to be smart about this stuff. And it's also about freedom. It's also about making certain that the government doesn't use its most potent monopoly on force to take away your liberty for a capricious offense. So these are the sorts of things that I think are uniting these groups. I'm looking forward to the conference today.
Representative Lewis, Chuck Schumer made some news last week when he said he was going to sort of spearhead an effort in the Senate to take marijuana off of the federal drug scheduling list and a federal decriminalization of marijuana. Do you get the sense, at least on the House side of things with your colleagues, that that's got any steam, that that's got any momentum?
Well, I don't know. I've certainly been out front on that one, too. I've sponsored the Compassionate Care Act and a number of things trying to the Respect State Marijuana Laws Act of 2017, the SAFE Act of 2017, the Small Business Tax Equity Act of 2017. If you're leaf line in the 2nd District and you're trying to find medical solutions using THC or something, but you can't engage in credit transactions, you have to do everything in cash. There's lots of obstacles here, but the fact is that this is another issue that's also, in my view, very conservative. I mentioned earlier that prohibition in general doesn't work, whether it's alcohol or firearms or marijuana in many cases. But the bottom line is, do we believe in the 10th Amendment or do we not? If a state wants to do an experiment with their criminal law, that's up to the state. Unless there's a direct interstate nexus, I think the Fed should get out of that.
Give it to the states. Give it to the states.
With this criminal justice reform forum happening today, again, Minnesota State Capitol, room 316, starting at 2. Holly, expectations for people that come today. What will they get out of it? What do they expect to see in terms of the conversation?
Well, I hope they'll feel sort of a renewed desire to get involved. I mean, I think with our political climate so acidic, a lot of people, especially younger people, I'm now 41, so I'm not in that category. But a lot of these millennials, I mean, they're just not interested. And my hope is that they'll see two individuals who have almost nothing in common and agree on almost nothing. But they're in lockstep pretty much on criminal justice reform issues. And I hope we're going to have some really informed discussion. Minnesota is very unique. I mean, every time I come here, it's amazing to me. It really has stayed away from sort of the acidity of the Beltway. And it is focused on getting things done for the people of Minnesota. And I credit the congressman for his leadership because he's really doing the right thing on the Hill right now.
How did Minnesota become a state of interest for your group, the Justice Action Network, and the work that you're doing?
Well, it was, I think, again, because you had folks on the right and folks on the left willing to work together. You know, politics is cyclical, and I worked in politics for years. I was the general counsel of the Republican Party of Kentucky, and, you know, power ebbs and flows. And if you've got an organization that can always speak to power like ours can, mm-hmm. You know, you've got an issue that's got some sustainability, and criminal justice reform isn't going anywhere. So, you know, Minnesota is really fertile ground for us. We've got legislation moving at the State House right now, civil asset forfeiture reform bill that I think has got some real juice. And I can tell you, in addition to this being sound policy, you know, saving money, pushing back on government overreach, making communities safer, it's also sound politics. We've polled in more than a dozen states across the country in these issues, without exception, poll in the high 60s, 70s, 80s, mm-hmm. and in some cases, 90s. I mean, the congressman's pushing sentencing reform with the Safe Justice Act. You know, in Ohio and in Michigan, sentencing reform, reforming these egregious mandatory minimum sentences, polls in Ohio at 89% and in Michigan at 91%.
Wow.
You don't win those states, you don't win the presidency. So, you know, in addition to this being sound policy, it's great good politics.
No, Holly's right. Good policy makes good politics. And the asset reform bill, the FAIR Act, asset forfeiture reform, I should say, is crucial to this. The idea that, you've got due process rights, but your property doesn't, so we can take your property, is an affront to everyone because your due process involves your property. So all of this is good stuff, and it's going to be a great forum today.
Representative Lewis, I want to thank you for focusing on this issue. We've talked about it with you a number of times on the show, and I just want to let you know that it is very much appreciated that you know, Minnesota has a representative, has someone up there that's focusing on this issue. This is not an issue that you people grandstand on. This is not an issue that gets you on the Sunday morning talk shows, but it is very, very important. It's it's kind of the grunt work of what you do, and for, you know, for a new-ish representative like yourself to be diving into it as strongly as you have, I want you to know that it is recognized and it is very much appreciated.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that.
And thanks for joining us. Always a pleasure to chat with you. Holly Harris, thank you so much.
Thank you for the beautiful weather here in Minnesota.
Yeah, before we let you go, where can people find out more about Justice Action Network and the work you guys are doing?
So we're on Twitter at US Justice Action. Okay. We also have a website, justiceactionnetwork.org. And if, you know, you're into humorous tweets, you can always follow me, Holly_Harris.
I've tweeted out a link. If you follow the hashtag TCNT, you'll see a link with Holly's tagged in it. So you can just click on that and follow her. And again, this is happening today at the state capitol, 2 o'clock. You've got Jason Lewis, Melvin Carter, Invergrove Heights Police Chief Paul Schnell, and of course Holly Harris, our guest. Thank you so much. It's great to have you in.
Thanks for the great hospitality here.
Coming up, I hate to bring the show to a screeching halt, but on the way, we will tell you that Al Franken is poised to make his first appearance in quite a long time.
No, God, yeah. Please, no!
Yeah, and this amazing, stellar, insightful, informative piece about Tina Smith from the Star Tribune. Can't wait to give you all the details. Justice in